always found a way to reinvent and reconstitute itself. For example, in the early 1930s, Germany was not the only democracy hit by the financial crisis and the Great Depression. In the United States too, unemployment reached 25%, and average incomes for workers in many professions fell by more than 40% between 1929 and 1933. It was clear that the United States couldn't go on with business as usual. Yet, no Hitler took over in the United States, and no Lenin did either. Instead, in 1933, Franklin Delano Roosevelt orchestrated the New Deal and made the United States the global arsenal of democracy. US democracy after the Roosevelt era was significantly different from before, providing a much more robust social safety net for citizens, but it avoided any radical revolution. Ultimately, even Roosevelt's conservative critics fell in line behind many of his programs and achievements, and did not dismantle the New Deal institutions when they returned to power in the 1950s. The economic crisis of the early 1930s had such different outcomes in the United States and Germany because politics is never the product of only economic factors. The Weimar Republic didn't collapse just because of 3 years of high unemployment. Just as important, it was a new democracy, born in defeat, and lacking robust institutions and deep-rooted support. When both conservatives and progressives resist the temptation of radical revolution and stay loyal to democratic traditions and institutions, democracies prove themselves to be highly agile. Their self-correcting mechanisms enable them to ride the technological and economic waves better than more rigid regimes. Thus, those democracies that managed to survive the tumultuous 1960s, like the United States, Japan, and Italy, adapted far more successfully to the computer revolution of the 1970s and 1980s than either the communist regimes of Eastern Europe or the fascist holdouts of Southern Europe and South America. The most important human skill for surviving the 21st century is likely to be flexibility. And democracies are more flexible than totalitarian regimes. While computers are nowhere near their full potential, the same is true of humans. This is something we have discovered again and again throughout history. For example, one of the biggest and most successful transformations in the job market of the 20th century resulted not from a technological invention, but from unleashing the untapped potential of half the human species. To bring women into the job market didn't require any genetic engineering or some other technological wizardry. It required letting go of some outdated myths and enabling women to fulfill the potential they always had. In the coming decades, the economy will likely undergo even bigger upheavals than the massive unemployment of the early 1930s or the entry of women to the job markets. The flexibility of democracies, their willingness to question old mythologies, and their strong self-correcting mechanism will therefore be crucial assets. Democracies have spent generations cultivating these assets. It would be foolish to abandon them just when we need them most. Unfathomable. In order to function, however, democratic self-correcting mechanisms need to understand the things they are supposed to correct. For a dictatorship, being unfathomable is helpful because it protects the regime from accountability. For a democracy, being unfathomable is deadly. If citizens, lawmakers, journalists, and judges cannot understand how the state's bureaucratic system works, they can no longer supervise it and they lose trust in it. Despite all the fears and anxieties that bureaucrats have sometimes inspired, prior to the computer age, they could never become completely unfathomable because they always remained human. Regulations, forms, and protocols were created by human minds. Officials might be cruel and greedy, but cruelty and greed were familiar human emotions that people could anticipate and manipulate, for example, by bribing the officials. Even in a Soviet gulag, or a Nazi concentration camp, the bureaucracy wasn't totally alien. Its so-called inhumanity actually reflected human biases and flaws. The human basis of bureaucracy gave humans at least the hope of identifying and correcting its mistakes. For example, in 1951, bureaucrats of the Board of Education in the town of Topeka, Kansas, refused to enroll the daughter of Oliver Brown at the elementary school near her home. Together with 12 other families who received similar refusals, Brown filed a lawsuit against the Topeka Board of Education, which eventually reached the U.S. Supreme Court. All members of the Topeka Board of Education were human beings, and consequently Brown, his lawyers, and the Supreme Court judges had a fairly good understanding of how they made their decision and of their probable interests and biases. The board members were all white, the Browns were black, and the nearby school was a segregated school for white children. It was easy to understand then that racism was the reason why the bureaucrats refused to enroll Brown's daughter in the school. It was also possible to comprehend where the myths of racism originally came from. Racism argued that humanity was divided into races, that the white race was superior to other races, that any contact with members of the black race could pollute the purity of whites, and that therefore black children should be prevented from mixing with white children. This was an amalgam of two well-known biological dramas that often go together: Us versus Them, and Purity versus Pollution. Almost every human society in history has enacted some version of this biodrama, and historians, sociologists, anthropologists, and biologists understand why it is so appealing to humans, and also why it is profoundly flawed. While racism has borrowed its basic plotline from evolution, the concrete details are pure mythology. There is no biological basis for separating humanity into distinct races, and there is absolutely no biological reason to believe that one race is pure while another is impure. American white supremacists have tried to justify their position by appealing to various hallowed texts, most notably the U.S. Constitution and the Bible. The U.S. Constitution originally legitimized racial segregation and the supremacy of the white race, reserving full civil rights for white people and allowing the enslavement of black people. The Bible not only sanctified slavery in the Ten Commandments and numerous other passages, but also placed a curse on the offspring of Ham, the alleged forefather of Africans, saying that "the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers," Genesis 9:25. Both of these texts, however, were generated by humans, and therefore humans could comprehend their origins and imperfections and at least attempt to correct their mistakes. It is possible for humans to understand the political interests and cultural biases that prevailed in the ancient Middle East and in 18th century America, and that caused the human authors of the Bible and of the US Constitution to legitimate racism and slavery. This understanding allows people to either amend or ignore these texts. In 1868, the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution granted equal legal protection to all citizens. In 1954, in its landmark Brown v. Board of Education verdict, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that segregating schools by race was an unconstitutional violation of the 14th Amendment. As for the Bible, while no mechanism existed to amend the 10th Commandment or Genesis 9:25, humans have reinterpreted the text in different ways through the ages, and ultimately came to reject its authority altogether. In Brown v. Board of Education, U.S. Supreme Court justices felt no need to take the biblical text into account. But what might happen in the future if some social credit algorithm denies the request of a low-credit child to enroll in a high-credit school? As we saw in Chapter 8, computers are likely to suffer from their own biases and to invent intercomputer mythologies and bogus categories. How would humans be able to identify and correct such mistakes? And how would flesh-and-blood Supreme Court justices be able to decide on the constitutionality of algorithmic decisions? Would they be able to understand how the algorithms reach their conclusions? These are no longer purely theoretical questions. In February 2013, a drive-by shooting occurred in the town of La Crosse, Wisconsin. Police officers later spotted the car involved in the shooting and arrested the driver, Eric Loomis. Loomis denied participating in the shooting, but pleaded guilty to two less severe charges, attempting to flee a traffic officer and operating a motor vehicle without the owner's consent. When the judge came to determine the sentence, he consulted with an algorithm called Compass, which Wisconsin and several other US states were using in 2013 to evaluate the risk of reoffending. The algorithm evaluated Loomis as a high-risk individual, likely to commit more crimes in the future. This algorithmic assessment influenced the judge to sentence Loomis to 6 years in prison, a harsh punishment for the relatively minor offenses he admitted to. Loomis appealed to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, arguing that the judge violated his right to due process. Neither the judge nor Loomis understood how the Compass algorithm made its evaluation, and when Loomis asked to get a full explanation, the request was denied. The Compass algorithm was the private property of the North Point Company, and the company argued that the algorithm's methodology was a trade secret. Yet, without knowing how the algorithm made its decisions, how could Loomis or the judge be sure that it was a reliable tool free from bias and error? A number of studies have since shown that the Compass algorithm might indeed have harbored several problematic biases, probably picked up from the data on which it had been trained. In Loomis versus Wisconsin, 2016, the Wisconsin Supreme Court nevertheless ruled against Loomis. The judges argued that using algorithmic risk assessment is legitimate even when the algorithm's methodology is not disclosed either to the court or to the defendant. Justice Anne Walsh Bradley wrote that since Compass made its assessment based on data that was either publicly available or provided by the defendant himself, Loomis could have denied or explained all the data the algorithm used. This opinion ignored the fact that accurate data may well be wrongly interpreted, and that it was impossible for Loomis to deny or explain all the publicly available data on him. The Wisconsin Supreme Court was not completely unaware of the danger inherent in relying on opaque algorithms. Therefore, while permitting the practice, it ruled that whenever judges receive algorithmic risk assessments, these must include written warning for the judges about the algorithm's potential biases. The court further advised judges to be cautious when relying on such algorithms. Unfortunately, this caveat was an empty gesture. The court did not provide any concrete instruction for judges on how they should exercise such caution. In its discussion of the case, the Harvard Law Review concluded that most judges are unlikely to understand algorithmic risk assessments. It then cited one of the Wisconsin Supreme Court justices, who noted that despite getting lengthy explanations about the algorithm, they themselves still had difficulty understanding it. Loomis appealed to the US Supreme Court. However, on June 26, 2017, the court declined to hear the case, effectively endorsing the ruling of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Now consider that the algorithm that evaluated Loomis as a high-risk individual in 2013 was an early prototype. Since then, far more sophisticated and complex risk assessment algorithms have been developed and have been handed more expansive purviews. By the early 2020s, citizens in numerous countries routinely get prison sentences based in part on risk assessments made by algorithms that neither the judges nor the defendants comprehend. And prison sentences are just the tip of the iceberg. The right to an explanation. Computers are making more and more decisions about us, both mundane and life-changing. In addition to prison sentences, Algorithms increasingly have a hand in deciding whether to offer us a place at college, give us a job, provide us with welfare benefits, or grant us a loan. They similarly help determine what kind of medical treatment we receive, what insurance premiums we pay, what news we hear, and who would ask us on a date. As society entrusts more and more decisions to computers, it undermines the viability of democratic self-correcting mechanisms and of democratic transparency and accountability. How can elected officials regulate unfathomable algorithms? There is, consequently, a growing demand to enshrine a new human right, the right to an explanation. The European Union's General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, which came into effect in 2018, says that if an algorithm makes a decision about a human, refusing to extend us credits, for example, that human is entitled to obtain an explanation of the decision and to challenge that decision in front of some human authority. Ideally, that should keep in check algorithmic bias and allow democratic self-correcting mechanisms to identify and correct at least some of the computer's more grievous mistakes. But can this right be fulfilled in practice? Mustafa Suleiman is a world expert on this subject. He is the co-founder and former head of DeepMind, one of the world's most important AI enterprises, responsible for developing the AlphaGo program, among other achievements. AlphaGo was designed to play Go, a strategy board game in which two players try to defeat each other by surrounding and capturing territory. Invented in ancient China, the game is far more complex than chess. Consequently, even after computers defeated human world chess champions, experts still believed that computers would never best humanity in Go. That's why both Go professionals and computer experts were stunned in March 2016 when AlphaGo defeated the South Korean Go champion Lee Sedol. In his 2023 book, The Coming Wave, Suleiman describes one of the most important moments in their match, a moment that redefined AI, and that is recognized in many academic and governmental circles as a crucial turning point in history. It happened during the second game in the match, on March 10, 2016. Then came move number 37, writes Suleiman. It made no sense. AlphaGo had apparently blown it, blindly following an apparently losing strategy no professional player would ever pursue. The live match commentators, both professionals of the highest ranking, said it was a very strange move and thought it was a mistake. It was so unusual that Sedol took 15 minutes to respond and even got up from the board to take a walk outside. As we watched from our control room, the tension was unreal. Yet, as the endgame approached, that mistaken move proved pivotal. AlphaGo won again. Go's strategy was being rewritten before our eyes. Our AI had uncovered ideas that hadn't occurred to the most brilliant players in thousands of years. Move 37 is an emblem of the AI revolution for two reasons. First, it demonstrated the alien nature of AI. In East Asia, Go is considered much more than a game. It is a treasured cultural tradition. Alongside calligraphy, painting, and music, Go has been one of the four arts that every refined person was expected to know. For over 2,500 years, tens of millions of people have played Go, and entire schools of thought have developed around the game, espousing different strategies and philosophies. Yet during all those millennia, human minds have explored only certain areas in the landscape of Go. Other areas were left untouched because human minds just didn't think to venture there. AI, being free from the limitations of human minds, discovered and explored these previously hidden areas. Second, Move 37 demonstrated the unfathomability of AI. Even after AlphaGo played it to achieve victory, Suleiman and his team couldn't explain how AlphaGo decided to play it. Even if a court had ordered DeepMind to provide Lee Sedol with an explanation, nobody could fulfill that order. Suleiman writes, "Us humans face a novel challenge. Will new inventions be beyond our grasp? Previously, creators could explain how something worked, why it did what it did, even if this required vast detail. That's increasingly no longer true. Many technologies and systems are becoming so complex that they're beyond the capacity of any one individual to truly understand them. In AI, the neural networks moving toward autonomy are, at present, not explainable. You can't walk someone through the decision-making process to explain precisely why an algorithm produced a specific prediction. Engineers can't peer beneath the hood and easily explain in granular detail what caused something to happen. GPT-4, AlphaGo, and the rest are black boxes, their outputs and decisions based on opaque and impossibly intricate chains of minute signals. The rise of unfathomable alien intelligence undermines democracy. If more and more decisions about people's lives are made in a black box, so voters cannot understand and challenge them, democracy ceases to function. In particular, what happens when crucial decisions, not just about individual lives, but even about collective matters like the Federal Reserve's interest rate, are made by unfathomable algorithms? Human voters may keep choosing a human president, but wouldn't this be just an empty ceremony? Even today, only a small fraction of humanity truly understands the financial system. A 2016 survey by the OECD found that most people had difficulty grasping even simple financial concepts like compound interest. A 2014 survey of British MPs, charged with regulating one of the world's most important financial hubs, found that only 12% accurately understood that new money is created when banks make loans. This fact is among the most basic principles of the modern financial system. As the 2007-08 financial crisis indicated, more complex financial devices and principles, like those behind CDOs, were intelligible to only a few financial wizards. What happens to democracy when AIs create even more complex financial devices and when the number of humans who understand the financial system drops to zero? The increasing unfathomability of our information network is one of the reasons for the recent wave of populist parties and charismatic leaders. When people can no longer make sense of the world, and when they feel overwhelmed by immense amounts of information they cannot digest, they become easy prey for conspiracy theories, and they turn for salvation to something they do understand. A human. Unfortunately, while charismatic leaders certainly have their advantages, no single human, however inspiring or brilliant, can single-handedly decipher how the algorithms that increasingly dominate the world work and make sure that they are fair. The problem is that the algorithms make decisions by relying on numerous data points, whereas humans find it very difficult to consciously reflect on a large number of data points and weigh them against each other. We prefer to work with single data points. That's why, when faced by complex issues, whether a loan request, a pandemic, or a war, we often seek a single reason to take a particular course of action and ignore all other considerations. This is the fallacy of the single cause. We are so bad at weighing together many different factors that when people give a large number of reasons for a particular decision, it usually sounds suspicious. Suppose a good friend failed to attend our wedding. If she provides us with a single explanation, "My mum was in the hospital and I had to visit her," that sounds plausible. But what if she lists 50 different reasons why she decided not to come? "My mum was a bit under the weather and I had to take my dog to the vet sometime this week, and I had this project at work and it was raining and..." I know none of these 50 reasons by itself justifies my absence, but when I added all of them together, they kept me from attending your wedding. We don't say things like that, because we don't think along such lines. We don't consciously list 50 different reasons in our mind, give each of them a certain weight, aggregate all the weights, and thereby reach a conclusion. But this is precisely how algorithms assess our criminal potential or our creditworthiness. The Compass algorithm, for example, made its risk assessments by taking into account the answers to a 137-item questionnaire. The same is true of a bank algorithm that refuses to give us a loan. If the EU's GDPR regulations force the bank to explain the algorithm's decision, the explanation will not come in the shape of a single sentence. Rather, it is likely to come in the form of hundreds or even thousands of pages full of numbers and equations. Our algorithm, the imaginary bank letter might read, uses a precise point system to evaluate all applications, taking 1,000 different types of data points into account. It adds all the data points to reach an overall score. People whose overall score is negative are considered low credit persons, too risky to be given a loan. Your overall score was -378, which is why your loan application was refused. The letter might then provide a detailed list of the 1,000 factors the algorithm took into account, including things that most humans might find irrelevant, such as the exact hour the application was submitted, or the type of smartphone the applicant used. Thus, on page 601 of its letter, the bank might explain that you filed your application from your smartphone, which was the latest iPhone model. By analyzing millions of previous loan applications, our algorithm discovered a pattern. People who use the latest iPhone model to file their application are 0.08% more likely to repay the loan. The algorithm therefore added 8 points to your overall score for that. However, at the time your application was sent from your iPhone, its battery was down to 17%. By analyzing millions of previous loan applications, our algorithm discovered another pattern. People who allow their smartphone's battery to go below 25% are 0.5% less likely to repay the loan. You lost 50 points for that. You may well feel that the bank treated you unjustly. Is it reasonable to refuse my loan application, you might complain, just because my phone battery was low? That, however, would be a misunderstanding. The battery wasn't the only reason, the bank would explain. It was only one out of 1,000 factors our algorithm took into account. But didn't your algorithm see that only twice in the last 10 years was my bank account overdrawn? It obviously noticed that, the bank might reply. Look on page 453. You got 300 points for that. But all the other reasons brought your aggregated score down to -378. While we may find this way of making decisions alien, it obviously has potential advantages. When making a decision, it is generally a good idea to take into account all relevant data points, rather than just one or two salient facts. There is much room for argument, of course, about who gets to define the relevance of information. Who decides whether something like smartphone models, or skin color, should be considered relevant to loan applications? But no matter how we define relevance, the ability to take more data into account is likely to be an asset. Indeed, the problem with many human prejudices is that they focus on just one or two data points, like someone's skin color, disability, or gender, while ignoring other information. Banks and other institutions are increasingly relying on algorithms to make decisions, precisely because algorithms can take many more data points into account than humans can. But when it comes to providing explanations, this creates a potentially insurmountable obstacle. How can a human mind analyze and evaluate a decision made on the basis of so many data points? We may well think that the Wisconsin Supreme Court should have forced the North Point Company to reveal how the Compass algorithm decided that Eric Loomis was a high-risk person. But if the full data was disclosed, could either Loomis or the court have made sense of it? It's not just that we need to take numerous data points into account. Perhaps most important, we cannot understand the way the algorithms find patterns in the data and decide on the allocation of points. Even if we know that a banking algorithm detracts a certain number of points from people who allow their smartphone batteries to go below 25%, how can we evaluate whether that's fair? The algorithm wasn't fed this rule by a human engineer. It reached that conclusion by discovering a pattern in millions of previous loan applications. Can an individual human client go over all that data and assess whether that pattern is indeed reliable and unbiased? There is, however, a silver lining to this cloud of numbers. While individual laypersons may be unable to vet complex algorithms, a team of experts getting help from their own AI sidekicks can potentially assess the fairness of algorithmic decisions even more reliably than anyone can assess the fairness of human decisions. After all, while human decisions may seem to rely on just those few data points we are conscious of, in fact, our decisions are subconsciously influenced by thousands of additional data points. Being unaware of these subconscious processes, when we deliberate on our decisions or explain them, we often engage in post-hoc single-point rationalizations for what really happens as billions of neurons interact inside our brain. Accordingly, if a human judge sentences us to 6 years in prison, how can we, or indeed the judge, be sure that the decision was shaped only by fair considerations and not by a subconscious racial bias, or by the fact that the judge was hungry? In the case of flesh and blood judges, the problem cannot be solved, at least not with our current knowledge of biology. In contrast, when an algorithm makes a decision, we can, in principle, know every one of the algorithm's many considerations and the exact weight given to each. Thus, several expert teams, ranging from the US Department of Justice to the non-profit newsroom ProPublica, have picked apart the COMPASS algorithm in order to assess its potential biases. Such teams can harness not only the collective efforts of many humans, but also the power of computers. Just as it is often best to set a thief to catch a thief, so we can use one algorithm to vet another. This raises the question of how we can be sure that the vetting algorithm itself is reliable. Ultimately, there is no purely technological solution to this recursive problem. No matter which technology we develop, we will have to maintain bureaucratic institutions that will audit algorithms and give or refuse them the seal of approval. Such institutions will combine the powers of humans and computers to make sure that new algorithmic systems are safe and fair. Without such institutions, even if we pass laws that provide humans with a right to an explanation, and even if we enact regulations against computer biases, who could enforce these laws and regulations? Nosedive. To vet algorithms, regulatory institutions will need not only to analyze them, but also to translate their discoveries into stories that humans can understand. Otherwise, we will never trust the regulatory institutions and might instead put our faith in conspiracy theories and charismatic leaders. As noted in Chapter 3, it has always been difficult for humans to understand bureaucracy because bureaucracies have deviated from the script of the biological dramas, and most artists have lacked the will or the ability to depict bureaucratic dramas. For example, novels, movies, and TV series about 21st century politics tend to focus on the feuds and love affairs of a few powerful families, as if present-day states were governed in the same way as ancient tribes and kingdoms. This artistic fixation with the biological dramas of dynasties obscures the very real changes that have taken place over the centuries in the dynamics of power. Because computers will increasingly replace human bureaucrats and human mythmakers, this will again change the deep structure of power. To survive, democracies require not just dedicated bureaucratic institutions that can scrutinize these new structures, but also artists who can explain the new structures in accessible and entertaining ways. For example, This has successfully been done by the episode Nosedive in the sci-fi series Black Mirror. Produced in 2016, at a time when few had heard about social credit systems, Nosedive brilliantly explained how such systems work and what threats they pose. The episode tells the story of a woman called Lacey, who lives with her brother Ryan, but wants to move to her own apartment. To get a discount on the new apartment, she needs to increase her social credit score from 4.2 to 4.5 out of 5. Being friends with high-score individuals gets your own score up, so Lacey tries to renew her contact with Naomi, a childhood friend who is currently rated 4.8. Lacey is invited to Naomi's wedding, but on the way there she spills coffee on a high-score person, which causes her own score to drop a little, which in turn causes the airline to deny her a seat. From there, everything that can go wrong does go wrong. Lacey's rating takes a nosedive, and she ends in jail with a score of less than 1. This story relies on some elements of traditional biological dramas. Boy meets girl, the wedding, sibling rivalry, the tension between Lacey and Ryan, and most important, status competition, the main issue of the episode. But the real hero and driving force of the plot isn't Lacey or Naomi, but rather the disembodied algorithm running the social credit system. The algorithm completely changes the dynamics of the old biological dramas, especially the dynamics of status competition. Whereas previously humans were sometimes engaged in status competition, but often had welcome breaks from this highly stressful situation, the omnipresent social credit algorithm eliminates the breaks. Nosedive is not a worn-out story about biological status competition, but rather a prescient exploration of what happens when computer technology changes the rules of status competitions. If bureaucrats and artists learn to cooperate, and if both rely on help from the computers, it might be possible to prevent the computer network from becoming unfathomable. As long as democratic societies understand the computer network, their self-correcting mechanisms are our best guarantee against AI abuses. Thus, the EU's AI Act, proposed in 2021, singled out social credit systems like the one that stars in Nosedive as one of the few types of AI that are totally prohibited, because they might lead to discriminatory outcomes and the exclusion of certain groups, and because they may violate the right to dignity and non-discrimination and the values of equality and justice. As with total surveillance regimes, so also with social credit systems. The fact that they could be created doesn't mean that we must create them. Digital anarchy. The new computer network poses one final threat to democracies. Instead of digital totalitarianism, it could foster digital anarchy. The decentralized nature of democracies and their strong self-correcting mechanisms provide a shield against totalitarianism, but they also make it more difficult to ensure order. To function, a democracy needs to meet two conditions. It needs to enable a free public conversation on key issues, and it needs to maintain a minimum of social order and institutional trust. Free conversation must not slip into anarchy. Especially when dealing with urgent and important problems, the public debate should be conducted according to accepted rules, and there should be a legitimate mechanism to reach some kind of final decision, even if not everybody likes it. Before the advent of newspapers, radios, and other modern information technology, no large-scale society managed to combine free debates with institutional trust, so large-scale democracy was impossible. Now, with the rise of the new computer network, might large-scale democracy again become impossible? One difficulty is that the computer network makes it easier to join the debate. In the past, organizations like newspapers, radio stations, and established political parties acted as gatekeepers, deciding who was heard in the public sphere. Social media undermined the power of these gatekeepers, leading to a more open, but also more anarchical public conversation. Whenever new groups join the conversation, they bring with them new viewpoints and interests, and often question the old consensus about how to conduct the debate and reach decisions. The rules of discussion must be negotiated anew. This is a potentially positive development, one that can lead to a more inclusive democratic system. After all, correcting previous biases and allowing previously disenfranchised people to join the public discussion is a vital part of democracy. However, in the short term, this creates disturbances and disharmony. If no agreement is reached on how to conduct the public debate and how to reach decisions, the result is anarchy rather than democracy. The anarchical potential of AI is particularly alarming, because it is not only new human groups that it allows to join the public debate. For the first time ever, democracy must contend with the cacophony of non-human voices too. On many social media platforms, bots constitute a sizable minority of participants. One analysis estimated that out of a sample of 20 million tweets generated during the 2016 US election campaign, 3.8 million, almost 20%, were generated by bots. By the early 2020s, things got worse. A 2020 study assessed that bots were producing 43.2% of tweets. A more comprehensive 2022 study by the digital intelligence agency SimilarWeb found that 5% of Twitter users were probably bots, but they generated between 20.8% and 29.2% of the content posted to Twitter. When humans try to debate a crucial question like whom to elect as US president, what happens if many of the voices they hear are produced by computers? Another worrying trend concerns content. Bots were initially deployed to influence public opinion by the sheer volume of messages they disseminated. They retweeted or recommended certain human-produced content, but they couldn't create new ideas themselves, nor could they forge intimate bonds with humans. However, the new breed of generative AI tools like ChatGPT can do exactly that. In the 2023 study published in Science Advances, researchers asked humans and ChatGPT to create both accurate and deliberately misleading short texts on issues such as vaccines, 5G technology, climate change, and evolution. The texts were then presented to 700 humans who were asked to evaluate their reliability. The humans were good at recognizing the falsity of human-produced disinformation, but tended to regard AI-produced disinformation as accurate. So, what happens to democratic debates when millions, and eventually billions, of highly intelligent bots are not only composing extremely compelling political manifestos and creating deepfake images and videos, but also able to win our trust and friendship? If I engage online in a political debate with an AI, it is a waste of time for me to try to change the AI's opinions. Being a non-conscious entity, it doesn't really care about politics, and it cannot vote in the elections. But the more I talk with the AI, the better it gets to know me, so it can gain my trust, hone its arguments, and gradually change my views. In the battle for hearts and minds, intimacy is an extremely powerful weapon. Previously, political parties could command our attention, but they had difficulty mass-producing intimacy. Radio sets could broadcast a leader's speech to millions, but they could not befriend the listeners. Now a political party, or even a foreign government, could deploy an army of bots that build friendships with millions of citizens, and then use that intimacy to influence their worldview. Finally, algorithms are not only joining the conversation, they are increasingly orchestrating it. Social media allows new groups of humans to challenge the old rules of debate. But negotiations about the new rules are not conducted by humans. Rather, As explained in our previous analysis of social media algorithms, it is often the algorithms that make the rules. In the 19th and 20th centuries, when media moguls censored some views and promoted others, this might have undermined democracy, but at least the moguls were humans and their decisions could be subjected to democratic scrutiny. It is far more dangerous if we allow inscrutable algorithms to decide which views to disseminate. If manipulative bots and inscrutable algorithms come to dominate the public conversation, this could cause democratic debate to collapse exactly when we need it most. Just when we must make momentous decisions about fast-evolving new technologies, the public sphere will be flooded by computer-generated fake news. Citizens will not be able to tell whether they are having a debate with a human friend or a manipulative machine, and no consensus will remain about the most basic rules of discussion or the most basic facts. This kind of anarchical information network cannot produce either truth or order and cannot be sustained for long. If we end up with anarchy, the next step would probably be the establishment of a dictatorship, as people agree to trade their liberty for some certainty. Ban the bots. In the face of the threat algorithms pose to the democratic conversation, democracies are not helpless. They can and should take measures to regulate AI and prevent it from polluting our infosphere with fake people spewing fake news. The philosopher Daniel Dennett has suggested that we can take inspiration from traditional regulations in the money market. Ever since coins and later banknotes were invented, it was always technically possible to counterfeit them. Counterfeiting posed an existential danger to the financial system because it eroded people's trust in money. If bad actors flooded the markets with counterfeit money, the financial system would have collapsed. Yet, the financial system managed to protect itself for thousands of years by enacting laws against counterfeiting money. As a result, only a relatively small percentage of money in circulation was forged, and people's trust in it was maintained. What's true of counterfeiting money should also be true of counterfeiting humans. If governments took decisive action to protect trust in money, it makes sense to take equally decisive measures to protect trust in humans. Prior to the rise of AI, one human could pretend to be another, and society punished such frauds. But society didn't bother to outlaw the creation of counterfeit humans, since the technology to do so didn't exist. Now that AI can pass itself off as human, it threatens to destroy trust between humans and to unravel the fabric of society. Dennett suggests, therefore, that governments should outlaw fake humans as decisively as they have previously outlawed fake money. The law should prohibit not just deepfaking specific real people, creating a fake video of the US president, for example, but also any attempt by a non-human agent to pass itself off as a human. If anyone complains that such strict measures violate freedom of speech, they should be reminded that bots don't have freedom of speech. Banning human beings from a public platform is a sensitive step, and democracies should be very careful about such censorship. However, banning bots is a simple issue. It doesn't violate anyone's rights, because bots don't have rights. None of this means that democracies must ban all bots, algorithms, and AIs from participating in any discussion. Digital agents are welcome to join many conversations, provided they don't pretend to be humans. For example, AI doctors can be extremely helpful. They can monitor our health 24 hours a day, offer medical advice tailored to our individual medical conditions and personality, and answer our questions with infinite patience. But the AI doctor should never try to pass itself off as a human. Another important measure democracies can adopt is to ban unsupervised algorithms from curating key public debates. We can certainly continue to use algorithms to run social media platforms. Obviously, no human can do that. but the principles the algorithms use to decide which voices to silence and which to amplify must be vetted by a human institution. While we should be careful about censoring genuine human views, we can forbid algorithms to deliberately spread outrage. At the very least, corporations should be transparent about the curation principles their algorithms follow. If they use outrage to capture our attention, let them be clear about their business model and about any political connections they might have. If the algorithm systematically disappears videos that aren't aligned with the company's political agenda, users should know this. These are just a few of numerous suggestions made in recent years for how democracies could regulate the entry of bots and algorithms into the public conversation. Naturally, each has its advantages and drawbacks, and none would be easy to implement. Also, since the technology is developing so rapidly, regulations are likely to become outdated quickly. What I would like to point out here is only that democracies can regulate the information market and that their very survival depends on these regulations. The naive view of information opposes regulation and believes that a completely free information market will spontaneously generate truth and order. This is completely divorced from the actual history of democracy. Preserving the democratic conversation has never been easy, and all venues where this conversation has previously taken place, from parliaments and town halls to newspapers and radio stations, have required regulation. This is doubly true in an era when an alien form of intelligence threatens to dominate the conversation. The future of democracy. For most of history, large-scale democracy was impossible because information technology wasn't sophisticated enough to hold a large-scale political conversation. Millions of people, spread over tens of thousands of square kilometers, didn't have the tools to conduct a real-time discussion of public affairs. Now, ironically, democracy may prove impossible because information technology is becoming too sophisticated. If unfathomable algorithms take over the conversation, and particularly if they quash reasoned arguments and stoke hate and confusion, public discussion cannot be maintained. Yet if democracies do collapse, it will likely result not from some kind of technological inevitability, but from a human failure to regulate the new technology wisely. We cannot foretell how things will play out. At present, however, it is clear that the information network of many democracies is breaking down. Democrats and Republicans in the United States can no longer agree on even basic facts, such as who won the 2020 presidential elections, and can hardly hold a civil conversation anymore. Bipartisan cooperation in Congress, once a fundamental feature of US politics, has almost disappeared. The same radicalizing processes occur in many other democracies, from the Philippines to Brazil. When citizens cannot talk with one another, and when they view each other as enemies rather than political rivals, democracy is untenable. Nobody knows for sure what is causing the breakdown of democratic information networks. Some say it results from ideological fissures, but in fact, in many dysfunctional democracies, the ideological gaps don't seem to be bigger than in previous generations. In the 1960s, the United States was riven by deep ideological conflicts about the civil rights movement, the sexual revolution, the Vietnam War, and the Cold War. These tensions caused a surge in political violence and assassinations, but Republicans and Democrats were still able to agree on the results of elections. They maintained a common belief in democratic institutions like the courts, and they were able to work together in Congress at least on some issues. For example, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed in the Senate with the support of 46 Democrats and 27 Republicans. Is the ideological gap in the 2020s that much bigger than it was in the 1960s? And if it isn't ideology, what is driving people apart? Many point the finger at social media algorithms. We have explored the divisive impact of social media in previous chapters, but despite the damning evidence, it seems that there must be additional factors at play. The truth is that while we can easily observe that the democratic information network is breaking down, we aren't sure why. That itself is a characteristic of the times. The information network has become so complicated, and it relies to such an extent on opaque algorithmic decisions and intercomputer entities, that it has become very difficult for humans to answer even the most basic of political questions. Why are we fighting each other? If we cannot discover what is broken and fix it, large-scale democracies may not survive the rise of computer technology. If this indeed comes to pass, what might replace democracy as the dominant political system? Does the future belong to totalitarian regimes? Or might computers make totalitarianism untenable too? As we shall see, human dictators have their own reasons to be terrified of AI. Chapter 10. Totalitarianism. All power to the algorithms? Discussions of the ethics and politics of the new computer network often focus on the fate of democracies. If authoritarian and totalitarian regimes are mentioned, it is mainly as the dystopian destination that we might reach if we fail to manage the computer network wisely. However, as of 2024, more than half of us already live under authoritarian or totalitarian regimes, many of which were established long before the rise of the computer network. To understand the impact of algorithms and AI on humankind, we should ask ourselves what their impact will be not only on democracies like the United States and Brazil, but also on the Chinese Communist Party and the Royal House of Saud. As explained in previous chapters, the information technology available in pre-modern eras made both large-scale democracy and large-scale totalitarianism unworkable. Large polities like the Chinese Han Empire and the 18th century Saudi Emirates of Diriyah were usually limited autocracies. In the 20th century, new information technology enabled the rise of both large-scale democracy and large-scale totalitarianism. But totalitarianism suffered from a severe disadvantage. Totalitarianism seeks to channel all information to one hub and process it there. Technologies like the telegraph, the telephone, the typewriter, and the radio facilitated the centralization of information, but they couldn't process the information and make decisions by themselves. This remained something that only humans could do. The more information flowed to the center, the harder it became to process it. Totalitarian rulers and parties often made costly mistakes, and the system lacked mechanisms to identify and correct these errors. The democratic way of distributing information, and the power to make decisions, between many institutions and individuals worked better. It could cope far more efficiently with the flood of data, and if one institution made a wrong decision, it could eventually be rectified by others. The rise of machine learning algorithms, however, may be exactly what the Stalins of the world have been waiting for. AI could tilt the technological balance of power in favor of totalitarianism. Indeed, whereas flooding people with data tends to overwhelm them and therefore leads to errors, flooding AI with data tends to make it more efficient. Consequently, AI seems to favor the concentration of information and decision-making in one place. Even in democratic countries, few corporations like Google, Facebook, and Amazon have become monopolies in their domains, partly because AI tips the balance in favor of the giants. In traditional industries like restaurants, size isn't an overwhelming advantage. McDonald's is a worldwide chain that feeds more than 50 million people a day, and its size gives it many advantages in terms of costs, branding, and so forth. You can nevertheless open a neighborhood restaurant that could hold its own against the local McDonald's. Even though your restaurant might be serving just 200 customers a day, you still have a chance of making better food than McDonald's and gaining the loyalty of happier customers. It works differently in the information market. The Google search engine is used every day by between 2 and 3 billion people, making 8.5 billion searches. Suppose a local startup search engine tries to compete with Google. It doesn't stand a chance. Because Google is already used by billions, it has so much more data at its disposal that it can train far better algorithms, which will attract even more traffic, which will be used to train the next generation of algorithms, and so on. Consequently, in 2023, Google controlled 91.5% of the global search market. Or consider genetics. Suppose several companies in different countries try to develop an algorithm that identifies connections between genes and medical conditions. New Zealand has a population of 5 million people, and privacy regulations restrict access to their genetic and medical records. China has about 1.4 billion inhabitants and laxer privacy regulations. Who do you think has a better chance of developing a genetic algorithm? If Brazil then wants to buy a genetic algorithm for its healthcare system, it would have a strong incentive to opt for the much more accurate Chinese algorithm than the one from New Zealand. If the Chinese algorithm then hones itself on more than 200 million Brazilians, it will get even better, which would prompt more countries to choose the Chinese algorithm. Soon enough, most of the world's medical information would flow to China, making its genetic algorithm unbeatable. The attempt to concentrate all information and power in one place, which was the Achilles heel of 20th century totalitarian regimes, might become a decisive advantage in the age of AI. At the same time, as noted in an earlier chapter, AI could also make it possible for totalitarian regimes to establish total surveillance systems that make resistance almost impossible. Some people believe that blockchain could provide a technological check on such totalitarian tendencies, because blockchain is inherently friendly to democracy and hostile to totalitarianism. In a blockchain system, decisions require the approval of 51% of users. That may sound democratic, but blockchain technology has a fatal flaw. The problem lies with the word users. If one person has 10 accounts, she counts as 10 users. If a government controls 51% of accounts, then the government constitutes 51% of the users. There are already examples of blockchain networks where a government is 51% of users. And when a government is 51% of users in a blockchain, it has control not just over the chain's present, but even over its past. Autocrats have always wanted the power to change the past. Roman emperors, for example, frequently engaged in the practice of damnatio memoriae, expunging the memory of rivals and enemies. After the emperor Caracalla murdered his brother and competitor for the throne, Geta, he tried to obliterate the latter's memory. Inscriptions bearing Geta's name were chiseled out, coins bearing his effigy were melted down, and the mere mentioning of Geta's name was punishable by death. One surviving painting from the time, the Severan Tondo, was made during the reign of their father, Septimius Severus, and originally showed both brothers together with Septimius and their mother, Julia Domna. But someone later obliterated Geta's face and even smeared excrement over it. Forensic analysis identified tiny pieces of dry shit where Geta's face should have been. Modern totalitarian regimes have been similarly fond of changing the past. After Stalin rose to power, he made a supreme effort to delete Trotsky, the architect of the Bolshevik Revolution and the founder of the Red Army, from all historical records. During the Stalinist Great Terror of 1917,